We are we're going to start today's momentous events, if I can just have your attention. Just before I introduce our speaker, by no coincidence whatsoever, we have another major media event, which is taking place on the 27th. And it started out as a lunch, and it's got all grown up and ended up as a dinner. It's with Jeremy O'Grady, who is the founder of The Week. And I'm looking at the bookings. They're already very starting to get quite heavy. So if you're interested in that, please put a booking in as soon as possible. Our speaker today, David Schlesinger, is the editor-in-chief of Reuters News. It says here, Reuters News, Thomson Reuters. I want to get all these titles correct in case anybody criticizes me. Reuters is known for being correct. You know, in the old days, life used to be very simple. Some of us were in the retail news business, and some of us were in the wholesale news business. I was in the retail news business, and we shamelessly used Reuters to fill in the gaps. That phrase, take in Reuters, appeared in many people's copy. Not mine, of course, but other people's copy. But Reuters, of course, now is much less, I wouldn't say it's much less a news organization, but it's no longer by any means a news organization. It's a far bigger company. And David Schlesinger was saying before this lunch that part of his job is to make sure that the news gathering from the 3,000 reporters that, or 3,000 people working in the news department that Reuters had, to make sure that their content gets into all parts of the company. I imagine that in itself is quite a considerable job. David is no stranger to Hong Kong. He's just reminded me, although I think I vaguely knew this, that in fact he first came here in 1982 working for Elsie Elliott, better known these days as LC2, who was then, I think, probably one of the most outstanding personalities working among poor people in Hong Kong, working for education, doing that sort of thing. By 1982, he was back again as a reporter with the Hong Kong Standard, working also for Newsweek, and back again in 87 with the Reuters Bureau here, then in Taiwan, then in Beijing, and then he turned straight and became an executive. No more grubby journalism. We're very pleased to welcome David Schlesinger. His topic today is news in the digital world with a journalism and journalists. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. I still try to be grubby, and have done all my life. It's really a bit daunting to be talking about the future of news following Claire Hollingworth's 99th birthday celebration by just a few days. If you think back a century, and news needs and news methods were really completely different. And anyone at that time pretending to foresee the future that she has actually lived would have failed utterly. Just think that the first air mile flight between Britain and Hong Kong did not land until 1936. And yet today, at my home in London, or anywhere around the world that I'm traveling, I get a rich and vibrant stream of news, photographs, stories, gossip from Asia into my home via Twitter, Facebook, Google Reader, and then all the more long-established methods of journalism. It's a cornucopia. But the real problem with any overflowing horn is that it is really only scarcity that creates an awareness of value. And in fact, the profession of journalism is losing both value and respect. The latest Gallup poll showed a record high 57% of Americans saying that they had little or no trust in the mass media to do what the media has always proclaimed to be its primary mission, to report fully, accurately, and fairly. Instead, people look to their friends, their community, for information, for validation, for argument, and for illumination. What is great about 2010 is that technology has created a completely new concept of community, and it has given that community new powers to inform and to connect. Facebook status updates become a news feed created by people I know and even often like. A Twitter feed is a new service of facts, opinions, and referrals from an ever-vigilant army of people with similar interests and proclivities. They alert me to news and articles that are almost guaranteed to fit my interests because we are a group that is formed around each other. And it is a self-correcting group where each of us has the ability to fire, replace, and refine the membership at will. No reader selected me to be editor-in-chief of Reuters. I was selected by the corporation to lead the news service in its interest. Conversely, no corporation selected the people whom I follow on Twitter. No board set my blog role. No executive committee befriended my Facebook pals. I did these things. What technology has done is it has upended the power equation to give control to the end consumer. The beauty of that is obvious. Control is always satisfied. The danger is that without care, it becomes an information universe that is too hermetically sealed. The days of the all-powerful paternalistic editor may be dead, but what can't replace them is the era of people only having their preconceived ideas reinforced. What's needed is a new model, one that combines push and pull. What's needed is a publishing model that embraces both the professionalism of the journalist and the power of the community. The great press critic A.J. Liebling wrote that freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns one. Today's technology means that the means of production and the means of distribution actually belong to anyone with access to an internet on-ramp. If you ask the public, what will you pay for? The answer is certainly a yes for tools: iPad, iPhone, BlackBerry, Android phone. The answer is certainly a yes for broadband and for access. But what about content? And what about those who create content? Far too often, the answer is no. I know even when I last lived in Hong Kong 15 years ago, this was an issue that the FCC itself had to wrestle with. What was the ideal ratio of full-time correspondent members to journalist members, to associate members, to corporate members? I guess I looked at the website and I saw a special promotion offer that Kalb has been running for new correspondent and journalist members. So I suppose that this means this is still an issue, both because there are fewer people who fit the bill, and also because those who fit the bill can't necessarily pay the bill. I'm lucky to be leading a journalistic organization 3,000 professionals strong. That's an extraordinary figure at a time when other organizations have been shedding staff. By comparison, in 1987, the year I joined Reuters in Hong Kong, and the year I first became a member of this club, I was one of 1,581 journalists in the company. We've survived and thrived and doubled by changing. We aren't the agency we once were. Tomorrow, we will be even more different than today. My job is to ensure that survival and to ensure that the journalistic tradition of today is actually melded with the traditions we had yesterday, bringing the social media ethos and combining it with our traditions. So let's start by thinking back 2 years. The photographs of distraught, confused, and angry bankers leaving their offices jobless helped symbolize the seismic shifts in the financial system 24 months ago. During the same period, thousands of journalists lost their livelihood too, as the profession and craft changed almost beyond recognition. If we have learned anything from these past 2 years, it has been that pure facts are not enough. Pure facts don't tell enough of the story. Pure facts won't earn their way. The arguments about whether the factual seeds of the financial crisis had been adequately reported are ultimately meaningless. The facts were there, but they weren't put together in a way that was compelling enough or powerful enough to change the course of events. We've been drowning in facts, and that deluge continues to threaten. How different from October 1851, when Julius Reuter set up his pigeon and telegraph shop, sending out facts to a world that was then starved of them. Today, it's context, connectedness, and community that matter. Context, connectedness, and community. That's why the traditional agency or wire pouring out a never-ending stream of more just can't be the answer. That's why we must be a service to our customers and to our readers. That's why This is the age of the publisher. Journalists who understand this will survive. Those who don't will be irrelevant. A publishing ethos is not defined by the number of stories we deliver. It's defined by our ability to keep our clients tuned in and returning. We do that with a heightened knowledge of what they need and with focused breaking news and insight that is fast, relevant, actionable, and engaging. Deploying all our multimedia assets allows us to tell stories compellingly via packages of interlinked news and information. And we will enable clients to connect to us and to each other. I'm as excited by content that gets created in a chat room by journalists and readers interacting together as I am about a good story being pushed out. Sometimes I'm even more excited because the intelligent interaction between people who all know something about a topic can create a much smarter product than any one writer struggling at the computer alone. Is that journalism? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is pure journalism. Sometimes it's commentary. Sometimes it's simply a sharing of ideas or the annotating of a graphic. But whatever you call it, it is an intelligent service between the journalist and the customer, and that's something we all must be aiming for. Why? Because like the pure journalism of old, it helps make sense of the world. Why? Because it is news, data, content, and information that is actionable because it adds insight to transparency. It's the community that interacts with information, and in that interaction creates yet more and better content. It's the context and analysis around the news that helps people make better decisions, helps them to do their jobs better, and gives them an edge in making sense out of the confusion around us. It is also the humility to know that the old one-way relationship between editor and audience has no place in the world anymore. There's huge learning to be had from the audience. Some of it comes from listening to its expertise. Some of it comes from watching its behavior. Much of it comes from enabling the conversation you get when you combine the facts, the data, the journalism, analysis, and fact-based opinion in a really smart way. The rules of today's journalistic world are these. Knowing the story is not enough. Telling the story is only the beginning. The conversation about the story is as important as the story itself. The more you try to be paternalistic and authoritative, the less people will believe you. The more you cede control to your audience, the more people will respect you. The more you embrace new technology as a platform, the more your ideas will compete. The more you abandon the faceless and the characterless, the more you can actually set the agenda. The more you look beyond the story for connections, the more value you will have. And if you have value and no one else does, you will get paid. Is it simple? No. But it is exciting and it is transforming. So now let me put my words to the test and let's have that conversation between audience and speaker, and see in that interaction whether we can create more and better content. So, questions, comments, reactions?
Can you just, let's... thank you very much. I think you all know the rules. If you'd like to make a comment or ask something, just identify who you are, and we will take it from there.
Diane.
Diane Storm, JMSC. I see that the Reuters website has tightened up its commentary, its ability to take comments, and you were suffering from a lot of vested interests who were basically pushing various religious and secular ideas onto you. So how do you deal with that, and what are you going to do in future?
Right. Well, first, let me say that there are really two parts to the commentary that I'm talking about. So Reuters does have a consumer-facing side that we do on Reuters.com. We also have the professional side, where we have our professional terminals and banks and brokerages, and where we provide news and information and data and trading capabilities to the financial world. And just so that everybody knows how the world works, if I relied only on our consumer side, I wouldn't have 3,000 journalists. In fact, if you the editorial budget is probably greater than our entire media revenue. So news, as Steve actually said in the introduction, powers all of the products that Thomson Reuters has. It powers all of our offerings into the professional world, as well as the media world and the consumer world. And I want to have conversation and commentary in all of that. So in our new products for the professional side, Icon, you may have seen the ads, or you will see soon when we launch it in Hong Kong, that will give professionals the ability to comment on stories that are aimed at them. So you can, and in the chat rooms where we have that's limited to people within the financial services industry who will talk about China, or they'll talk about gold, or they'll talk about German bonds or other scintillating subjects. And that conversation, to me, is as important as what you have on the consumer side. What you talked about was what we are doing on Reuters.com, where we had a very open comment service, and we lost control of it. And it just ended up people slagging each other off and a lot of stuff that didn't add value at all. So what we've done is we've actually tried to institute a point system to try to use the carrot and the stick to get better comments. Fundamentally, what happens is you have to register to put a comment in. The first time you comment, it will be moderated before it's published. You'll get a point for that. As you build up more credibility, then your comments can go in without moderation instantly. But it's like chutes and ladders. If you then have an outbreak of Tourette's syndrome, you'll go back to the start and you'll have to be moderated first.
Robin Meredith from Forbes. A vision of journalism that makes a lot of sense, but you also just explained that the pure journalistic side, the editorial side of your operation, doesn't make money and it's subsidized.
I didn't say that. What I said was the media business could not support the editorial operation that I have. That doesn't mean that we're subsidized as a charity. What it does mean is that the news we produce and the way in which we produce it and the way in which we publish it for a professional audience is of such value that we get that value back from the organization. So it's not a subsidy, it's just that news actually powers the whole Thomson Reuters enterprise.
So does that suggest, I was going to say, that most journalists who don't have a background or don't have a second audience, if you will, of professionals who are willing to pay more than usual, more than the average news consumer, that they're sort of doomed?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I think, and it raises the whole issue of paywalls, right? And so within our organization, we actually have a huge paywall, well, even though you can't really see it. Our website has all the news you want for free, no paywall at all, and yet there is a jump from free to $1,500 a month if you want that news together with data and trading capabilities and instant snaps. And I think the answer to your question, I'm not sure if it's doom, but certainly you cannot survive unless you have some way of getting paid. You get paid either by, we get paid by differentiating yourself. So my mantra to the news organization is always, our enemy is not Bloomberg, our enemy is commoditization. Because if I'm writing the same thing as you and you're writing the same thing as Tom over there, no one's gonna pay any of us. So we all have to, Forbes and The Economist and Reuters have to have their particular angle on the news. They have to add value in a particular way. And if you add value, you will get value. But I think that all you have to do is look around and see who has the large organizations now. And it's us, it's Bloomberg, it's News Corp, and that's about it. And Xinhua. So you know, either you are government subsidized, or you find ways of making your news relevant to an audience that is willing to pay large amounts of money.
Question down here.
Yeah, the question of who pays for Paul McIntosh from the ABCJ. The question of who pays for content is rather a different question from a news organization or a publisher than it is to an individual journalist. And the question, you know, will people pay for instance, anything beyond simply an iPad or some other form of or broadband access is simply a new different method of distribution. Reuters was a method of distribution. The newspapers were a method of distribution. This is not about, journalists themselves are the creators of the content, but people always paid only secondarily for the content, but primarily they paid a distributor. Has the internet really changed the dynamics of the value equation between content and distribution? Has all this unilateral, new disintermediated direct access from content producer to consumer really changed the power equation between the journalist and the editor come the news organization? Or despite all this, is the journalist come actual content producer just back where they were before in a slightly different context?
I think that nothing prepared me more for my current job than a few years of freelancing here in Hong Kong. Because it's really precisely the same question. How do you, whether you're an individual or whether you're an organization, how do you market the news that you're reporting and writing to someone who is willing to pay? When I was a freelancer, I had to distinguish myself from the other freelancers who were there. When I'm running a news service, I have to distinguish that news service from the other news providers who are available at a touch of a Google search. And that is what has changed. That is what has changed the dynamic, and that is that commoditization is so much more obvious than it once was. If I wrote a story and Diane wrote the same story back in 1982, and we provided it to different editors, we could probably get away with it. Today, you can't get away with it because it's clear to all what the basic facts are, clear to all what the basic take on the story is. Okay. Is there one way in the back there?
Good. Hi, David. I'm Min Lee from the Associated Press. I just had two questions. The first is you talk about the need to help readers make sense of the saturation of information out there, but you also talk about the need to build a sense of community and to listen to reader feedback. I mean, how do you strike a balance between the two to, let readers, let users drive the conversation and also, explaining to them, what's going on? How do those work together? And my second question is, can you talk a little bit more concretely about, what initiatives that Reuters is taking to move toward the vision that you described in your speech? Thank you.
Yeah, I think the answer to the first question is that it's a fluid process. So if you take something that happens in a chat room that we run on the professional side, you might have a journalist seed that chat room with something that she has reported, an interview that she's done, or some reporting that she's done. And then you'll have people react. A concrete example, we run a chat room about commodities, and we have a commodities commentator who will put graphs and some analysis into that chat room. We'll have people from brokerages send those graphs back annotated. They might put their own graphs in. That in turn creates more content. And so it's a dynamic relationship. In terms of concrete things, that kind of chat room activity for our professional customers is one thing. Another thing is what we're doing with video for professionals. We have a product called Reuters Insider, which is part of the Thomson Reuters Icon terminal and the Thomson One terminal for the buy side, where we do video for financial professionals by professional journalists, and we aggregate that with video content that's provided by our customers. So Goldman Sachs might provide their analyst videos. We have our stories that we provide on video. That's all linked together by search. And so somebody who is actually at their terminal can put in a keyword search and they'll get the relevant video from us, the relevant videos from other people, the news stories, the relevant data, they'll be able to comment on it. They'll get blogs that our journalists have written. And so that becomes a very dynamic, exciting way of seeing financial content that other people couldn't do before. And news is at the heart of that.
Can I just ask you, because I'm worried we'll get carried away with optimism, what are your thoughts on the future of print media, by which obviously I mean print on paper?
Future of print on paper. I got my start as a print journalist. I don't subscribe to a single newspaper on print anymore. I read the Financial Times on iPad. I read Us on iPad. I read Wall Street Journal on iPad. Anything else, I'll do a web search. So, and if I'm in the business, and I'm 50 years old, for God's sake, if I'm in the business and I'm 50 years old and I don't subscribe to a single print newspaper, what about someone who's 20 years younger than me? What about someone who's 30 years younger from me? I don't think that print itself has that much of a future. However, print on demand probably does. So something that is actually very popular that we're doing is we now do a lot of enterprise reporting. We bundle those together in PDFs that we make available on the terminal or on the website, and thousands upon thousands of people click on that and download it. So I think print on demand probably does have a future because people do like to take things with them. They do like to hand them out to customers, to clients, to friends. But that kind of broad distribution print, I don't have much optimism about that.
Charles.
Thank you. Mr. Schlesinger, just a quick question on something you brought up earlier in your remarks. Oh, I'm Joel Lakin, Lakin Communications. I think I'm addressing this question on behalf of the committee at AmCham that focused freedom of the press. So many people look at Hong Kong as having a great free press compared to many other areas in Asia, which are social democracies. Technically, Hong Kong isn't. In your judgment, where does Hong Kong rank in the free flow of information, freedom of press scale of things? I'd like to get your comment.
I've always felt that Hong Kong is one of the great places for the exchange of information. I don't think that that has changed that much. I think that still, if you think of the press as the totality of all the ways in which people exchange information, from blogs to websites to tweets to print to radio to TV, I think there is an awful lot. It's very vibrant here. Where it fits exactly, I don't know. But I do think that that this is an environment where people still have the ability to express themselves quite vibrantly, and that's just something that should be treasured.
Let me just before we come back, is there anybody else who hasn't asked a question? Let's just come over here first.
Hi, Azhar Rafi from RMG. David, one question is that I want to understand how the editorial writing, different genres that you cover, is changing for different technical devices. As print goes away, and you are seeing emergence of iPhones and iPads and Android, etc., the screen sizes are different. People have less time, and so on and so forth. Are you also seeing a shift in the way you write, the amount of information you convey, the number of updates, and so on and so forth? Because I think as people are more mobile, and then the attention spans are more fragmented, it has to have an impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about Reuters is that what's happened over just the 2.5 decades that I've been with the company is that our writing has styles have expanded tremendously. So when I started and we were the traditional wire service, it was basically 300 words and out, and that was about it. We did the alerts, so the breaks, and then stories were 300, 400 words, and maybe you do 600 words for a feature. But now, because of all the different types of clients we have from all sides of the financial services industry, through the entire media spectrum, through consumer, we do everything from that 80-character alert that people trade off of, all the way to the 3,000 word enterprise piece. And to me, that's something that's been just liberating, exciting, remarkable, that this 160-year-old former news service has been able to become a complete multimedia agency, a complete service writing all lengths and all sizes. When you get to the device question, that's more about how you publish and how you select and put together than actual writing style. So when we're putting together the websites and we're putting together what we display on an iPad, that's really in the selection. It's the marrying together of the video, the picture, the text, putting a link to a PDF for the long thing. But I think what I think has excited me the most about what we've been able to do just in the past few years is just expand out from that old wire service churn to actually thinking about how to tell stories across the whole span of media and the whole span of story types.
We have a question. Okay. Right. I don't have an eye line to the person over here, but.
Genevieve Hilton from BASF, and much like a lot of your readers, you can't see me, and I can't see you.
You could move. You could move if you like.
Oh, hi. So I was just talking. Right. I have to move up there. Okay. Sorry. This is getting more involved than I thought. I was talking before lunch to the person on my right-hand side who was wondering whether to advise her 15-year-old son whether to go into journalism. And I wanted to know, in two related questions, when you joined, you said there were 1,000-something people, and compared to now, what's the average pay of the journalist now and then? How does it compare? And do you have to work harder for every dollar now? Because it sounds what you just described, it sounds like you have to work very hard for every dollar.
Listen carefully to this answer.
We pay well, I think. I'm not sure if the people who work for me would agree, but as editor-in-chief, I would say we pay very well. It's hard to give you an average figure because we're in 190 places around the world. We have 80 different nationalities, and so it differs place by place. And I don't have the figure in Hong Kong at the top of my head. But you know, it's a competitive market for the best people. And I think when I speak to journalism students, which I do quite often, I say the key is to know something about something. And if you are simply a generalist who is a journalist who can do the plane crash in the morning, the market crash at night with sort of a basic, mediocre level of expertise, it's very hard to get paid for that, and it's very hard to get a job, because I get 6,587 resumes that look exactly like that across my desk every day. But if you have fluent Russian and you know about the Russian bond market, or you're a Turkish speaker and you're an expert in the EU, or you really understand regulation, or you've got great contacts in the US Congress, if you know something about something, you are incredibly valuable to me, and I will pay you tons of money for it. What was the second question? Do you work harder for the dollar? Yeah. So the answer to that is absolutely yes. You do work harder for it, because that goes to the question of commoditization. I mean, when I started, I mean, actually Tara Joseph, who's here today, I mean, Tara rather embarrassed me. Tara actually runs the Asia arm of that Reuters Insider video for Professional that she was telling about, and she was talking about her freelance days in Hong Kong when she would rip and read Reuters copy, and she said that she found one of my bylines the other day when she went through her old files, and that rather
very
embarrasses
well
me. Sorry?
Very well written.
Yeah, she may say it's very well written because she works for me, but I know very well that I was a hack, and certainly when I was freelancing, I was a hack, and when I started with Reuters, I was a hack because I was churning stuff out. I don't think you can churn stuff out today. I think you actually have to know your subject, you have to be good at your subject, you have to distinguish yourself. So I think it is much tougher now than it was.
So what are you, talking to that 15-year-old kid who maybe wants to be a journalist, learning Turkish, that's a possibility, but what would you really recommend that person to do to be the kind of person you want to find at age, whatever you want to find them to be
know something about something and prove that you can specialize. So when I talk about career paths within Reuters, I talk to people about serial specialization as opposed to being a generalist. So if someone actually is able to study Turkish and understand the Turkish, then I have the confidence that if they then go into the science beat, they'll be able to learn about biology as well to the right depth of knowledge. So I want someone who is a serial specialist who can prove the ability to specialize and then have the guts and excitement to go on to other things as well.
Dorothy Chen from CLP. I'm curious to hear, you know, what is the ratio between your IT staff with the newsroom staff? Because it sounds like, you know, you need a lot of people sorting, monitoring the comments, sorting information out. And also, from a journalist standpoint, do you expect, you've already mentioned the financial side, they expect you to moderate the chat rooms. But on the consumer side, who does the moderating, or how are they expected to go back every day to see what people have commented?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I laugh when you said that because Alex Spinelli, who's sitting right there, is the head of editorial technology, and we were having an argument today about how his budget is only 10% of the news gathering budget, and it really should be more. We don't spend enough on technology and news, but it helps to have some geniuses who make the most of every dollar that they get. I think technology is hugely important. It's important both in terms of getting, in terms of how you gather the news, how you display the news. For us, because so much of Thomson Reuters money comes from serving a trading community, it's how you deliver the news with split-second speed and accuracy. So technology plays an absolutely vital role in that, and we don't put enough resource into it. I mean, we could quadruple the amount, and it still probably wouldn't be enough. Not that you'll get that this year. And in terms of the moderation, yes, we do it with humans. Basically, on the consumer side, there's a queue that builds up, and we go through it. So that does mean if you haven't gotten enough points, it will take some time for your comments to appear. But we do hope that people will accumulate their points, that they'll go up that ladder with good comments, and then they'll go out immediately.
Mary, over.
Hi, Mary Kissel from the Wall Street Journal. Two quick questions. The first is, are news wires financially viable without an underlying data set? And second question, you've talked a lot about the commoditization of news as a threat. Do you also see it as a wonderful opportunity for brands that are trusted, given that people are looking at these thousands of source information? Why, is it really only a threat?
Two really good questions. So are news wires viable without underlying data set? I'm not sure what my friend from the AP will say to that. You have a comment? I mean, I'd be interested in your perspective too, because I wonder about Dow Jones having without a terminal. I mean, I think it's more than the data. I think it's actually having the means of distribution, and I think it's actually the means of distribution to where you aggregate news, data, trading with a common metadata, common search, common coding, that is what it's given Thomson Reuters and Bloomberg the power that they have in the market. I think without that, it is difficult. And I think what's the AP difficulties it has with its owner members in the US who are struggling financially themselves and no longer want to pay for the huge infrastructure around the world, I think it's a real problem and a real question, because if the average owner member of the AP uses this much of the AP content, which they actually have to pay for the production of this much, so it's a very difficult model. And I think what is good about our model is that our professional customers have an incredibly long tail. They use everything that we produce, because somewhere out there there's that trader who's interested in Bulgarian bonds. You may not be, I may not be, but if we write it, they'll use it and they'll pay for it. And in that model, actually, the more obscure you are, the more valuable you are, because you serve a niche. Whereas the old newswire model of producing everything for everybody becomes increasingly difficult to support. Your second question, around the value of trust. I would love to have it be true. I'm not sure that it is. And if you simply look at what happens when there is a big news story, a shooting in the United States, or even a car crash or an airplane crash, and where do people get their news? They get their news off a Twitter feed. They get their news off Google News. They get their news off Wikipedia to update. And I'm not sure that the old trust equation of trust equals old established enterprise actually pertains. I think where it does pertain is in the analysis to commentary space, where it is the personal brand of the commentator combined with the institutional brand that adds value. But on the basic fact side, I don't think it actually provides that much value at the moment. Sorry?
This is the advertising moment.
I would argue that they don't, because I would argue that the journal, and let me give you your plug, the journal puts an analytical edge into stories that's why I buy. I don't buy it for the basic facts. I don't buy it for the briefs. I buy it for the takeouts. And of course, the editorial page. The Asian editorial page, and soon the New York editorial page. Just to really make a plug here. But I wouldn't buy it for the basic news, because we do the news, and Bloomberg does the news, and everybody does the basic news. I do it for the scoops, and I do it, and I pay for it for the analytical edge.
Sorry. I'm afraid this is going to be the last one.
At the risk of being Larry King and tossing up a softball question, in today's context, it should be very easy. In today's context, define the word journalist.
Ah, very easy. No, I don't think I would even do that. I think that what today's context means that the definition is hugely broad. That's why we have the commoditization problem. I think a journalist is anyone who we've always been a self-declared profession. That's even more so now when we are a self-publishing, self-declared profession. So I think a journalist is anyone who says he is or says she is. The trick is, how do you then prove your value as a journalist and then get value in return? So the definition is not important. It's the value part of the chain that's important.
Well, David Schlesinger, thank you very much indeed. It's been extremely interesting. Nobody gets away from the FCC without a lingering memento. I believe this is waterproof, which is extremely important for people who are editors-in-chief. They get showered, and that's the only good thing that happens to them.
Thank you very much.